Welcome to the Industry Debate, the next 5 years, recorded at the Dentistry Show, NEC Birmingham, April 2016.
I'm Mark Getchford. I'm interested in you had a very good presentation this morning. I think you've covered a tremendous amount of ground, and I feel privileged to have sat here and listen to the presentation. My question's a little bit wider. The mouth is part of the body, and I actually believe that oral health is everybody's business. I think as dental professionals and dental industry workers, then obviously we look after it and we think it's ours. But actually, everything that goes into the mouth affects the body, and we know we have a lot of common risk factors around obesity and diabetes. So I'm actually interested in the panel's views about how can we as dental professionals engage the rest of the healthcare world and business in our agenda. Thank you.
Who would like to take that question?
I'll kick off with that. And is the microphone on? Yeah, great. Thank you, gentlemen, for that question. I absolutely agree with you about oral health being a big part in general health for stuff. But I'll come back with a challenge to NHS England and the Department of Health. I'm forgetting, I know I work for the CDC. But what I would say is, actually, there's a big part of government, Department of Health, NHS England can play in actually feeding the oral health agenda and the dental agenda into that wider agenda. Dentistry is always kept on one side. It's kept on one side with the funding, and it's kept on one side with its reputation. So I absolutely agree with you that it could happen, but actually you're in the best place to help.
I'd just like to say there's a lot of DCPs out there already promoting themselves to their community, especially with diabetes and heart disease links. So I think the industry, or dental industry, is actually trying to do that, but on their own. And again, we would appreciate help from Department of Health. And I'd just like to talk about myth-busting, really, because Public Health England in summer are going to be publishing 4 rapid reviews on the relationships between general health and oral health. So they're going to concentrate in the first instance on cardiovascular disease, on dementia, on diabetes, and on pulmonary disease, because I think we have to be absolutely stick to the evidence. You know, is it floss or die, or is it actually, you know, is there an association rather than a causal effect? So I think something about absolutely making sure what we know about relationships between oral health and general health, that's the first thing. And I think the second thing, I absolutely support making sure that we consider general health. That's why we do ask about smoking and alcohol because of periodontal disease, but it's also about the whole person. And there was a pilot in Greater Manchester, I don't know if people knew about it, about doing health checks. And what was interesting from that, the learning from doing the health checks, the actual dental nurses taking the questions, was that the evaluation afterwards was that they were saying things like, I came into dentistry to save teeth. I never thought I'd help to save lives. And that was a very powerful statement, actually. So I was second that.
Samantha, can I just jump in on that one? Because one of my practices was in the pilot Sandra's referring to, and it was an amazing journey that we went through looking at blood pressure, and it made me think, should I look at blood pressure for patients when they're about to go through a stressful environment? So it was a really interesting program that we worked with.
I just say from our perspective, we've got health and dental clinics, we've got both that work separately. But we try to encourage our dentists both in the UK, and in fact some of the work was led in Spain on programs called Healthy Heart, Happy Smile, the linkages between oral health and general health, diabetes, to periodontal disease, cardiovascular disease. We're trying to look at programs to link some of the health assessments that are done for patients, possibly with dental examinations as well. So we're encouraged by all of it that our professionals, our hygienists, our dentists, there's really an expectation that they're discussing with patients their general health, not just their dental health when they come to see us for their exams.
Just very quickly to answer everything that's been said, I think we're looking at risk assessment more in healthcare. We're looking at oral risk assessments, but your point's absolutely valid that we do perhaps have to broaden out to tie in and link some of the other systemic conditions which have big direct as well as indirect relationships to what we're actually doing for our own profession. Thank you, Roger.
Thanks, Abby. I'd like to make 2 points, please. I'll pick up on your last one first, which is risk assessment. Obviously, the NHS in the pilot, now the prototype program, is using risk assessments at the outset. That's very important. And at Denplan, we've developed the DEPA program, which provides, again, an evidence-based risk assessment. But more than just ticking boxes, more than just getting data on patients, it's a way of enhancing communication with patients so that the patient understands just what the impact of oral disease, both current and future, will be for them, and to make sure that patients both understand it, can act on that, and act sensibly, and act practically to change their lifestyle. And the other point I'd like to make is about the two ends of life. I'd like to say we had a child dental health roundtable at Parliament last summer, and one of the things that came out of that was that we would like to see every child in this country have a full oral health assessment by the age of one, which means that the parents get the information as well. And at the other end of life, as was pointed out earlier on by John Mill, we have this increasing problem of care homes where we have patients dying of aspirational pneumonia because they can't clean their teeth, they can't masticate their food, and I think that's a growing problem as well. So I think we have to look particularly at both ends of life. We also have to look at giving dentists and their teams, as has been said by Nikki, time to communicate effectively with patients so that patients understand. And yes, please, Janet, don't let dentistry be left out. So often we hear about collaborative working, and we talk about the pharmacists and the health visitors, the GPs, everybody else, and everyone goes, dentists? Oh yeah, we can include the dentists. Really important. Thank you.
Sorry, just one final point. Very, very simply, as dentists, we see people who think they're well. People come to us to have their mouth checked. They may not be aware of blood pressure, diabetes, or any of the other ailments that are there. And we have a massive opportunity to make a difference in that. We see the walking well. The doctors see the walking unwell. And it's sometimes it's too late at that point. I'd rather, through patient education, be able to prevent diabetes, blood pressure problems, cardiac episodes at a much earlier stage. We've all seen patients who all of a sudden, 10 years down the line, their medical history form takes them half an hour to complete. What were the signs and symptoms much earlier? And as a profession, if we were able to interact with that, I think we could make a significant difference.
Any more questions? Because what usually happens is a couple come and then they come a flood at the end and we've not got time. Yes.
Oh, the gentleman's
here, then you're next.
Sean Charlwood, I'm a dental practitioner in Lincoln, a vocational trainer, and I sit on the GDTC. Thank you for a very interesting talk, panel. We're talking about the future, and my question's particularly around our future dentists and new graduates. As a foundation trainer, I see a rush of new dentists to speciality training. And I think what concerns me is that I view general practice as a specialty in its own right. It's the real bedrock of the future dental provision for this country. What would your advice be to new graduates as far as that rush to specialist training, with a view as well towards commissioning guides and the needs that that's going to bring about?
I'll first give it that one, and okay. I think my advice to the young graduate would be, as Shauna says, don't rush to specialise and gain your basic skills. I think that's the first thing. But the second point I would make is, you can't fight the demographics of the disease, and the demographics of disease are changing. Far fewer people of the 12-year-olds and 15-year-olds we see will need endodontic treatment in the future. I think crowns and bridges and major restorative stuff will tend to diminish along with the heavy metal generation. So I think to maintain adequate skills to deliver quality care to patients, it's going to be necessary for young dentists to specialise to a degree. But I would say, gain your basic skills first and actually learn where your interests lie.
Thank you. Again, always agree with John anyway. But it's a really important question. It's a big debate we have at King's and all the other dental institutes around the country and actually around the world. The skill sets are changing. Exactly the point made, that the dentistry we're actually providing now is not the same dentistry that many of us learned 20, 30 years ago. It's not better or worse, it's different. So we have to change with the time. So I have debates about, you know, doing crown preps. You think about how many crown preps you did at undergraduate level. You look at what the grads are producing now, it's much less. But actually, technically, it's becoming a harder and harder skill to do because repairing fillings and teeth before cutting them to shreds. So the whole philosophy is changing. So the advice I give my students is general dentistry is a specialism. I completely agree with that. So that's why I've driven a postgraduate program to try to sort of push that. But getting out there, getting experience, but John's absolutely right. There's going to be subsets of techniques and technologies that we all learned as part of our routine BDS, which may not be routine BDS anymore. And I think that's just a shift in the way dentistry is progressing and moving again, perhaps more away from operative and more towards preventive.
Quick comment about patients' expectations have changed as well. So alongside the fact that the disease is changing, implants and all sorts of fancy things weren't around 30 years ago in the same way they are now.
I think the advice I would give new graduates is don't be frightened. The message I keep hearing from people is that the dental profession is scared, fearful of going to work, either because of the lawyers or because of the GDC. I think if we are ethical and safe practitioners who make good records, it doesn't matter whether you're in primary care or secondary care, it's the records of the interaction that you've had with a patient, whatever that was, is the key. Now, it wouldn't be somebody from dental protection speaking without the importance of record keeping. But if your records are good and you are communicating effectively with patients, they have nothing to fear, other than the fear of getting it wrong, which is, it's almost like a vicious circle. I agree, primary care is a specialty of itself. I think the development of the care pathways is going to have a massive impact on the whole of the profession, because I don't think the GDC are going to be that interested with somebody who puts veneers in somebody's mouth where there is active periodontal disease or caries. Because if you don't follow the care pathway, it's going to be misconduct, because you won't be acting in the patient's best interest. So I'm glad to have the conversation about care pathways. I think the private sector is sitting quietly hoping it's not going to happen, but they need to get with the program. It's happening and it's going to apply to them.
Just a brief comment. When I trained, that's the time when dinosaurs walked the earth, and slightly before John Mill trained, we treated teeth. We treated teeth. Occasionally we treated gums, but not very often. But we treated teeth. Now we treat people. And I think that's the huge difference. We treat people. And until you know people, you can't treat any particular aspect of their anatomy. And I think it was Kevin Lewis who coined the phrase, if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think that's another danger of specialism. So I fully agree with what my colleague has said.
Thank you. I'm going to cut you off. I think we're going to the next one, if that's okay. Lady.
Hiya, I'm Chloe. I work with GlaxoSmithKline, oral care manufacturer. So interesting to hear that you all mentioned about the companies and manufacturers before and partnering together. I just wanted to understand what you would be looking for over the next 5 years to help with VP issues that have come up.
I think they've got a huge part to play, and I think already they have responded, so that when Delivering Better Oral Health was published a few years ago, the original one, the companies responded by increasing their fluoride in those toothpastes that weren't at the correct level. And that's a huge, you know, if we could get our sugar companies to do the same things that our pharma companies are doing, that would be a marvellous way to go. We've also got a lot of the pharma companies are actually very helpful in terms of oral health improvement and prevention, and we'll back things and sponsor things. So to actually help to progress the agenda forward would be great. We have, if I can talk briefly about water fluoridation without being knocked off the stage here,
there is something around, the public are very fearful of fluoride, are very fearful of fluoridation, and actually it would be a tragedy if we ever lost the fluoride from toothpaste and everything else. And we do have a bit more of, work really with the public about socialising fluoride. And I think the companies, when you look at the sexy adverts on the television, they say fluoride toothpaste, but there is something about making sure that people are, and that's the same kind of fluoride that you get in water, by the way. You know, I don't expect to say that on the television, but it is about getting people used to the fact that this isn't a toxic chemical that's in your toothpaste, that's in the water. So that would, for me, that would be helpful. I would just say help and support in the education for the consumer, because it's all the advertising is very glitzy and glamoury, and I think we have, although education is quite a poor subject for the advertisers, I think there is a way around that we can work both together.
I'd say that empowered dental teams are really important, and one of the things we've been finding in our first year of CQC stuff is that leadership isn't always embedded all the way through practices, as we said earlier, and I think the people who are involved in all of the dental trade can play a big part in enabling those within the dental teams to be confident in the messages that they give the public, and also in the way they organise the practices.
Yes, that's a gentleman right about there.
Good morning, thank you, panel. Martin Fallowfield, I'm a dentist in Peterborough. I want to ask the panel about the difficult thing about money. We're looking to junior doctors going on strike, and it's really about resource. In dentistry, we've seen a long time now where patients pay for elements of care. How can we move in the next 5 years, panel, to a stage where the state's resources are being focused where the dentistry is needed rather than where it's wanted?
I'll pick up that question very gladly. I think the sum of £50 a year has been quoted widely. I won't attribute it as to what the state can afford to pay for the 55% and 56% of patients who visited a dentist in the last 24 months. In today's increasingly technical, increasingly regulated, increasingly widely scoped, we've just heard about holistic disease, dentistry has changed. It's no longer about one man sitting in a back room, which was a converted house, with perhaps one untrained or relatively untrained assistant, and maybe somebody out the front if he was lucky on the desk to take the appointments. We work in a hugely complex and technical and regulated business and profession, and rightly so. It should be that way. And I think we have to question where the money goes. There have been many, many, many calls for core services or specialised services or floor funding and all the rest of it. I don't know what that answer is. I've been battling with that answer since I was in mixed practice back in the 1970s and 80s. I still don't know what the answer is, but the answer has got to be that both the public and the private sector have a role to play. And I think it's a shame if we sit in trenches lobbing grenades at each other. And I think what has been welcome over the last 12 months, and I hope will be more welcome over the next 5 years, is that the private and public sectors can sit down together and have an intelligent, adult, politically sensitive, but above all, patient-focused conversation on how we can provide the best oral care. Sarah said, soon after her appointment, I want to see the move from dental treatment to oral care. And so say all of us, ladies and gentlemen. We can only achieve that through a sensible, grown-up conversation.
Just to build on that point, I think the wider skill mix is an absolute way to go, but to pick up on your need versus demand, I would think it's fairly safe to say that a lot of our patients demand service. They arrive at a time that they think, we trained them, as a profession, we've trained them to come every 6 months. And the reality is, do they need to? Possibly not. And I think this is particularly where the oral health pathways come in, the care pathways with the prototype. If the patient is absolutely educated, capable, has sound caries level, sound periodontal condition, do you really need to see them in 6 months' time? Probably not. And I think really we have to get into having a needs-based service to best spend those funds that are available centrally, and then the rest of it is private-public collaboration. It's got to be.
It's always a tricky question, is this one, as to where the money comes from. But actually, the money comes out of your pocket. Whichever way you do it, whether it's private, whether it's NHS, you pay for it one way, either through your taxes or through your own earnings. And I think where there needs to be a really serious debate is how much, particularly in terms of the public service, is how much is oral health worth to the government. I think if we ask the population, they'd say it's worth quite a lot to me. But equally well, as a profession, I think we have to acknowledge the debate about where the demographics of disease are taking us. If disease levels are falling in probably the largest bulk of the population, how much money does it actually cost to look after them properly? Certainly, from the organisation I work from, we're interested to see that care is delivered that's of the right quality and that's actually effective for the patient's needs.
I'd agree, as was said earlier, that dentistry, not just for children but for adults, is a largely preventable disease. It's quite a debate on where public money should be used, I think, for that. The balance for some patients between what they want and what they need. In the private sector, perhaps we can help them make their choices with their communication, influence, but there's such a deep question to this that we really do need to work together as a profession with the public and the government bodies if we're ever going to improve on this rather than, sort of say, just taking pot shots at each other. We can help with their plan. We have patient plans for 200,000 people to help people want to pay for themselves and for the value of their health. But there are a big body of our population that perhaps don't have the understanding of the needs that they have. We have to help them as a leadership group to come to terms with that.
I have to be slightly careful because we're in Perda at the moment and I'm a civil servant, and this is a real question about resources. So what I'll add is that you need to focus on prevention because that saves money in the long run. You have to focus on evidence-based dentistry, and you know it, that will save money in the long run in terms of not doing the things that don't work. And I think NHS commissioners quite frequently get a bad name, but I have seen some very smart commissioning in some areas where they have commissioned services in the poorest area with the greatest need, and actually that could be encouraged, and we should encourage that in the future.
Thank you. Anybody have any more thoughts? We've got a gentleman at the back here. The reason they should be shouting, stand up and shout. Back to you.
It's John Cho, general practitioner in Devon. And what I'm returning a little bit to something that's been partly considered earlier on in our discussion, and it's the ethical approach of the profession. When I was the chair of the standards committee of the GDC before the period of madness that we've heard about, I was very keen on a non-prescriptive approach or proscriptive approach to regulation, because I feel if you don't exercise a muscle, it withers. And the ethical muscle is one that we need to know how to develop. I've counted the number of young dentists that have worked in my practice over the last 40 odd years, well over 200. And I've seen young dentists join my practice with extremely high ethical principles, wonderful enthusiasm, and I've noticed that in many cases this decays as their career progresses. A very sad comment on our profession. And that's because we all think we want rules so that we know what to do. But unfortunately, that's developed into what we now recognize as a tick box culture. If you tick the box, nobody can get you. So dentists who are extremely clever people, when they're given a rule, the first thing they do is work out how to get around it. And nobody can make rules that a dentist can't discover a way around. It's a losing battle if you're in that business. What we really need is dentists who make their own rules. They've developed their ethical muscle. They know what ethics are. We all know what is right. We don't always do it. Why? Because not everybody else does either, or because we have our own self-interest higher than others. And that's a shame. And when I was on the GDC, I wanted to reduce the little small print rules that told us what to do and what we couldn't do, because I believe we should all know that. We should make a case for our own behaviour. And once you stop doing that, you don't know what right or wrong is very often, and that's a great pity. And this approach to looking after yourself, I think, spills over into a commercialization of the profession sometimes, where in the gentle journals, the most prominent articles are how you turn a patient into a customer, how you create a sale. That's not what we're here to do at all. We're here not to create a sale. Actually, it's to see if we can develop circumstances where the patient doesn't need treatment, not because we don't want to make them to want treatment, but that's one just small area that I'm concerned about as well. But I feel that the GDC and the CQC and all the regulators that have the profession's interest at heart should be thinking along these lines. Put the decision making about ethics in the hands of the professional, and then take them to task if they don't make the right decision themselves.
Right. Okay. Picking up some of those themes. I think the GDC rewrote its standards guidance in September 2013 to make it a much more patient-focused document. So the standards for dental professionals is a document that the profession need to use to understand what the patients expect of us. And I think we need to understand that the GDC's job, and also the CQC's job, is to make sure dental care is delivered safely. That is their job. The CQC does it by setting standards for the environment. The GDC does it by setting standards for the individual registrants. Actually, I think the GDC does a good job in that. The reason the GDC has been in chaos is because the fitness to practice arm has been in meltdown. That has been fixed and is being fixed as we speak. So the position for an individual dentist is to understand what standards expects of them, to understand what CQC expects of them, and to apply that on every single patient interaction, whether you're a dental nurse, a clinical dental technician, or a consultant maxillofacial surgeon who's not still on the dental register. But the madness at the GDC is that they've spent 44 million quid of our money erasing 100 people. They don't need to do that. They need to have a much more modern system of regulation that perhaps goes to the point John's making, which is about the ethical standard of the healthcare professional, rather than ticking boxes. I work with a past master of finding way around the rules, Brian Westbury. And if you ever have seen Brian in front of a tribunal of any sort, he will find a way, using the rules, to show that whatever. But you have to have, in order to protect the public, rules and regulations. If there are no rules, and the profession sets the rules, anarchy, as far as patients are concerned. They won't know what to expect. What the patients now need to know is what they can expect of me when I'm in the practice next Friday, that I will apply the standards the profession has set through the GDC, and that I will operate to the standards that the CQC has set for the practice I work in. We have to agree as a profession what the standards are. The GDC is a patient safety organisation setting standards to protect the public. That's what it is. Anyone who thinks it's anything else
is sadly misguided.
I'm going to resist the temptation to preach a sermon, but what I would say is that as far as the CQC is concerned at the moment, people say to us, can you give us a checklist? Can you give us a tick box? And our current answer is no, we won't. What we'll say to you is, can you show us how you deliver safe, effective, caring, responsive services that are actually well led? That's the mantra of the CQC. And we trust the individual professionalism of all people working within the dental team to actually think for themselves, okay, how can I deliver that? How can I deliver those things within my environment? John, you're right to challenge the individual ethics of the practitioner. We believe that high standards and professional standards start with the professional themselves.
I think one of the items that we need to focus on as well is the education side. And I know in our practice we have peer review, we've got four dentists and they'll all do the same thing differently. So there's a vast amount of you here today. If you didn't have some rules and regulations or standards to follow and guide us, then you're going to have 200 people doing everything a different way. So I do think it's a good thing that we ask a number of clinicians to actually set the standards and also the patients. Regarding publications and about selling and publicity within the dental industry, unfortunately, whether you're NHS or corporate, it is a business and we do have to run the business and we do have to look at cost savings and where the money is spent. So I think the articles about business are quite valid unless you're working for free.
I used to work for Primary Care Trust, so I've been responsible for performance managing some of the contracts and actually have been part of the team that have stopped contracts for dentists and referred people to GDC. So I'm passionate about safety for patients. However, I would like to challenge you on a couple of points. The first is that if you show dentists a rule, they'll get round it. And I hope within this room today, there are dentists sitting here that don't just look at a rule and think, how can I get around it, but actually recognise that it's to their patient's benefit. And I bet if I had a show of hands, there would be people here that say, yes, I do try and follow the rules, actually. And secondly, around your point around give dentists the choice about whether to work ethically or not, you have the choice to work ethically or not. And actually, having seen the worst of the deeds within the people that we used to commission, I am really pleased to say that the majority of my profession, my dental profession, are good, honest, hard-working people. And actually, we don't stick together as a profession to say that enough. And that's why the public don't trust us. And actually, you know, there's some really good people out there, and let's celebrate that as well as looking about how we regulation. I feel really passionately about that.
Thank you, everybody. I think I'm going to close there. Sorry about that. We're running out of time. So, thank you very much for coming to listen to us talk about teeth a little bit there.
I think it's been really interesting. It's given me more of an idea of where I'm going to perform next or quite easily. I've got to concentrate on my professional work. And again, thank you very much for coming. Enjoy the rest of the wine festival.
The industry debate, The Next 5 Years, was recorded at the dentistry show NEC Birmingham, April 2016, by 2020dentistry.com, and audio post-production by Mads Vid. With a special thank you to all the speakers and participants for taking part in the discussion and allowing us to share it. Thank you.